Hello there, this is Mark Bauerlein for another conversation. Today we have someone pretty well known to First Things readers, Philip Hamburger, who's professor of law at Columbia Law School. He is what was the last thing that you did for us?
The administrative threat.
Okay, right. And you've been over here for events as well. And I'll mention two books that you have. It is Administrative Law Unlawful. And then from a while ago, Separation of Church and State. And you're one of the experts on the separation of church and state issue with a slightly different interpretation from what the progressive interpretation has to be. Today we're going to talk about a new book, one that came out a few months ago, entitled Liberal Suppression, Section 50C3 and the Taxation of Speech. That is one exciting subtitle. Which you know, actually, at the beginning. But welcome, Philip. Welcome.
Well, thank you. It's great to be here. Thank you so much.
All right. Well. Let's just do some basics. What is 501c3?
Yeah. Well, it's probably the only revenue subsection that's actually known by name to many Americans. Although,
it's just a number. It's not.
It's just a number. And it doesn't inspire much excitement any more than any other revenue subsection, I suppose, except that it contains speech restrictions on churches, charities, and educational organizations. Restrictions, actually, that are aimed at the heart of their political speech. One of these is a restriction on attempts to use propaganda or other speech to influence legislation, and the other is a complete bar on campaign speech.
Is the word propaganda in the code, in the tax code?
That's right. It is rather curious. It's not a word you ordinarily expect in a federal statute. It bars a tax exemption to organizations, a substantial part of the activities of which is carrying on propaganda or otherwise attempting to influence legislation.
But one man's reason is another man's propaganda.
Indeed.
Where that line is awfully hard. So if you qualify for 501c3 and the IRS gives you that designation after reviewing, you apply to get a 501c3, the IRS reviews you to see if you are a not-for-profit that you do. Do you have to have some kind of social good rationale, or it's simply a financial judgment?
Right. So the categories of organizations that are given exemption by 501c3 are most centrally churches, educational organizations, and nonprofit educational organizations.
So Harvard University with a $50 billion endowment is a 501c3.
That's right. And okay. I actually have no objection to their being exempted from income tax because all of these, although they're technically known as nonprofits, sort of anodyne phrase that makes it seem as if it's just a technical problem, these are all idealistic organizations, not organizations designed to produce income. And so they're not really subject to the income tax, and the exemption demarcates this baseline.
This is just something that pops into my head. What about when a university supplies faculty members, say, who end up as political appointments in an administration for a few years and then go back to the university? No problem.
Well, look, I do worry about academics who get too involved in politics. All of us have to be careful that it doesn't twist our academic judgment. But why should we worry about people engaging in politics? I would have thought it's a good thing that at least if we are not selfish about it, that we engage in politics and participate in forming good policy. And perhaps especially from universities, that ought to be a good thing.
And this is really where we get down to your title, not your subtitle, suppression.
Right.
The word suppression, in which if you are a 501c3, you are your speech is suppressed.
Right.
If you want to keep it.
Yes, it's really very odd, isn't it? If you are a business, your speech is partly suppressed. If you are a political party, you are exempt, actually, from income tax, but you're not suppressed at all. But if you're a church, educational institution, or charity, then you have really quite sweeping restrictions on your speech, no campaign speech, and only very limited propaganda to influence legislation. And so my book attempts to explore this, to understand why we have this anomaly, why these speech restrictions, or which we ordinarily would say are appalling restrictions of political speech, why in this case we largely just ignore it and think it's normal.
So give me an example of a priest delivering a sermon that would jeopardize that church's 501c3
status. So we can draw a distinction. If a priest gets up in front of his congregation and says, just speaking for myself, personally, I think you should vote for Senator so-and-so, that's of no real significance under 501c3. But if he stands up and urges his parishioners to vote in a particular way or takes a statement on behalf of his congregation or church, that would violate these conditions in 501c3. And so churches and other idealistic organizations end up not silencing themselves altogether, but stifling their speech. Sophisticated idealistic organizations know how to play the game, and they can be quite involved in politics because they know the ins and outs. The smaller and poorer ones don't quite understand, and they are quite fearful and hush themselves down.
What if a priest, a bishop, wrote a column, had sort of a regular column, had a profile in the periodicals, the public periodicals, and consistently wrote about abortion, pro-life? At what point, if the Democratic Party becomes so firmly identified with pro-choice, at what point can they say, you taking such a hard line, if pro-life is everything in your writings, you're becoming partisan. You're no longer a nonpartisan figure. You are militating against the Democratic Party. Can they make a case against that church?
One can make a case. And in fact, 501c3 arises in part out of the reactions of politicians who want to silence their opponents. But 501c3 actually does not bar one from taking controversial positions, or what you might call partisan positions. Rather, the speech restrictions focus on campaigning, on saying vote for this person or not for that person.
Policy statements.
That's a different matter depending how it's phrased. If you're actually urging legislators to adopt one bill or another, then it's very important that this not be a substantial part of one's activities. But you can do a little on the edge of that. So it's not a barrier to partisan or political speech in general. The curiosity is it's a barrier to political speech in politics.
Right.
So political speech outside of politics, outside of trying to influence legislation and outside of campaigning, is quite unaffected by it. And this is one of the reasons why the severe restraint on political speech in politics has not received as much attention as it should.
So you can engage in political speech, just don't be too influential. Be too effective.
Well, even that is not the problem.
Yeah.
It focuses specifically on attempting to affect voters and attempting to affect legislators. In other words, it focuses on the ways in which political speech intersects with a Republican system of government. And that's not an accident, of course. That's because this arises out of some fears for the Republic.
Why did this mechanism end up in the tax code? I gather that we want institutions that really function as broad civic institutions. They rise above sort of the immediate political partisanship, because that's a social good. we need to have, I imagine that this comes out of an idea of classic liberalism that says we have to have some institutions that transcend politics in that narrow sense, and that rise to the level of civic institutions that everyone respects in just some spaces in political or in national life that are not politicized. We have to have those just for the social good. But now we're gonna maintain those through the tax code.
Right. Well, you know,
that's our mechanism.
The interesting thing is that churches have been very involved in politics in the history of this early history of this country. Right. We wouldn't have had the American Revolution, but for the participation of Calvinist pastors in New England. We would still have slavery if mostly Protestant clergymen hadn't united, especially in New England, to petition Congress and advocate repeatedly against slavery. In fact, one might, in some churches, this became perhaps a dominant trope. We wouldn't have had a civil rights movement in the 50s and 60s without
deeply Christian, right? Christian. Right.
And so, if one had asked Martin Luther King, is he
the Reverend Martin Luther King?
Exactly, the Reverend Martin Luther King. If one had asked him in what capacity is he fighting for civil liberties, would it be as a secular civil liberties leader or as a clergyman? And once one asks that question, one understands just how profoundly important religion is in politics. Now, one may not like the results. I can understand if someone disagrees with these results. It happens not to be my view, but I can understand differences of opinion. But churches, whether for good or for ill, have been central in our politics. And that gets to the question as to why they have to be singled out for such sweeping restrictions on speech. Political speech in particular.
Why do they?
Well, so that's the story my book begins with. And it is a curious story. I suppose the place to begin, though, is with the man who actually first proposed these dual speech restrictions, and because then one can get some entry into why and what lay behind it. His name was Hiram Evans. And in 1930, he proposes what become these two restrictions on speech. As he put it at one point, he says it a number of different ways. May a church use its spiritual authority to coerce voters or members who are in public office? And those are the two restrictions we have in 501c3. Hiram Evans begins his notable public career as the head of as a member of and head of a clavern in Dallas, Texas. A clavern of the Ku Klux Klan. In 1921, he and some other Klansmen barge into the Adolphus Hotel in Dallas. They seize a black bellhop, they drag him down to the river, they whip him, and they carve the letters KKK into his forehead with acid. Having distinguished himself in this way, Evans drew national attention, and the next year he's made the Imperial Wizard of the KKK. And he's quite a remarkable man. He is thuggish, but he's also quite brilliant and actually quite scholarly. He writes many scholarly articles against Catholicism, for example. And he understands that if the Klan is to be of national prominence, it has to appeal to theologically liberal anxieties about authority, in particular ecclesiastical authority. So he doesn't take aim narrowly at the Catholic Church. That's just the worst example to his mind. But he also more broadly condemns all church authority, even in Protestant churches. And it's that theologically liberal anxiety about authority in churches or churchy organizations that drives 501c3.
The KKK, when I imagine a lot of people hear that, they are a little shocked by that. But the 1920s were the high point of the KKK. They had, the estimates range around 4 or 5 million members, official members, in the KKK. The highest membership was not in the South. Ohio, Indiana, Illinois.
Right. And right
here in
New York,
there were the states where the biggest.
Right here in New York, if one looks at Klan newsletters, which is the sort of literature I'm afraid I have to wade through, one finds that in every little upstate village and town, there not only were claverns for the men, but also women's auxiliaries, the women of the KKK and the women of the Invisible Empire, ladies of the Invisible Empire. This was pervasive,
and as you said, very strongly anti-Catholic.
That's right.
Some people say they might have they were very influential in the was it Alfred Smith who was the first Catholic the first Catholic candidate for president, and they were mobilized against him. Right. Strongly.
And the key is to recognize, though, that the KKK is simply the most prominent group to hold these views in the 1920s, but there's nothing really distinctive about it in this regard. It was really one of many nativist organizations and non-nativist groups that held theologically liberal fears of church authority. And this has a long history, as you alluded to. Perhaps should we discuss that earlier history?
I want to go to a quote that you give that goes back to 1852. It's on page 62, where you really come down to the question of authority and an individual who submits to the authority of any higher doctrine, power, figurehead, really doesn't deserve to vote. This is a quotation from a man named Thomas Whitney. "The individual who places his conscience in the keeping of another divests himself of all individuality and becomes the creature, the very slave of his conscience keeper. In every sense, moral, social, and religious, he becomes a mere instrument." Okay. Why should he then get a vote? Because what that really means is a certain authority figure of some kind gets more than one vote. You are completely subordinating yourself for another. Does this play into the whole issue?
Yes. So the Americans who are worried about ecclesiastical authority, and then very soon not just the authority of churches, but also of other idealistic organizations, even of businesses and so forth, they're pursuing some sort of outlet for their fears. And one of these, of course, is simply to cut off voting rights for people whom they fear are deferring to others and not exercising their own democratic
judgment. They're taking orders from Rome.
That's right. Instead of a democratic individual exercising his own judgment, he's deferring to someone seemingly morally superior, religiously superior, and therefore perhaps to protect democracy, it becomes important to prevent such individuals from voting. And this, of course, doesn't get very far, and so other solutions have to be found. One solution is to try to destroy the Catholic Church. Proposals for this come up in the 1870s, but don't get very far. Another solution, of course, is to exclude Catholics from teaching in public schools. And this does seem to work for a time. And when that fails, one of the reasons that fails is that there are, of course, a large number of Catholic schools. Catholics respond by expanding their parochial schools so that kids don't have to go to public schools. And then, of course, is the movement to require children to go to public schools, because if you can get them in public schools, they're more likely to have a mentally liberated Protestant teacher. That fails in 1925 in Pierce versus Society of Sisters. The Supreme Court rejects this as unconstitutional, at which point the question becomes, well, what's the next solution? And the candidacy of Al Smith in 1927 brings to the attention of many Americans just how likely it is that perhaps Catholics will have a role in politics.
They have a lot of kids.
Yes, but it's, of course, not just Catholics. If it had been just Catholics, I don't think we'd have 501c3. There's a broader fear of all exertions of authority, of idealistic authority. And it's in this context that folks like Hiram Evans think, well, perhaps we should just prevent churches from engaging in politics, exerting their ecclesiastical authority in politics, and that would solve the problem. So it's the last of a series of measures, and this one stuck. If you can silence the organizations that exert ecclesiastical authority or idealistic authority, when you think of the non-religious 501c3 organizations, then you don't have to worry about threats to individual thought informing opinion in politics.
And individual thought really is about individual sovereignty, right? And that's democracy has to be based on individual sovereignty. And that's what makes the ideal institutions really significant here, right? Because you're not controlling people by physical restraint. You're controlling them, their ideas. They're controlling their will.
It is rather curious that we end up in a situation in which the organizations that are most completely excluded from the political process are those that are idealistic. If one's worried about the selfish forces in our society, one might actually favor the speech of these organizations. But that hasn't been the way it's worked out.
Do you think that this really what ends up being a hoping for a deterioration of creedal institutions of any kind, that this is sort of an inevitable strain of liberalism?
Right. So this gets back to the question of liberalism. The book is in part an account of the origins of 501c3 and an account of its unconstitutionality, at least of its speech restrictions. But more broadly, the book attempts to trace tendencies in American liberalism. The sad fact is that contemporary American liberalism has been much shaped by theological and even nativist thought. That's not the entirety of it, but it's something that needs to be recognized. So in the 18th century, many Americans identified as liberal, and it was a general cultural liberalism on the whole. And so the Constitution gets adopted in part on liberal assumptions because it's a way of overcoming local prejudices and interests of the states. But after the French Revolution, this general cultural liberalism takes a hit. It loses its popularity, at least it's not espoused in public as often as it had been, because it becomes associated with a radicalism that would seem to undermine its legitimacy. But what rises to the fore, what becomes very popular in 19th century America, is theological liberalism, which is this distrust of ecclesiastical authority. And already in the early 19th century, this has been broadened out. James Madison embraces theological liberalism in his so-called Detached Memoranda, and he then also raises such questions about business corporations. Are they unduly influential because of their wealth?
So this goes along with sort of that broad theme of decentralization.
It's a decentralization of the mind.
Yeah.
Not just of the polity. But of course, it intersects with that of the polity because nativists embrace a theologically liberal stance against the Catholic Church. It's not to say they're all theologically liberal personally or in their own churches, but against the Catholic Church, they adopt this position. And in that context, they ask, not only is the authority of a church a threat to the mental liberty of its adherents, but might it not also be a threat to the demos, to the democracy, to the ability of a people to govern themselves? And this is the beginning of elevating the state as to what's to be protected from churches.
And the state is not an orthodoxy. No, not at all.
Right. But it's essential to understand that this doesn't prevail merely because of anti-Catholicism. Anti-Catholicism, in a sense, is an opening wedge to popularize some of the more extreme versions of these ideas. But then it takes on a life of its own, and I think it's typical of contemporary liberalism to worry about the authority of idealistic organizations, especially if they are seemed orthodox, to worry about orthodox opinion. Yeah. And of course, in what's come to be known as a progressive strain of such thought, to worry about the wealth and influence of business corporations. And the effect, of course, is in some ways maybe liberating as individuals, but actually from a Tocquevillian point of view, quite dangerous for individuals, right? Because where do individuals find their strength vis-a-vis government? In their associations. Mm-hmm. He said, if we're all equal before government, we're all equally weak. We need organizations, in fact, to pursue our individuality.
You use the term worry. You have a nice phrase here, and you're talking about John Rawls, where Rawls doesn't want to make a straight-on attack on Orthodox Christianity, but, quote, his arguments carry forward the old theologically liberal anxieties about orthodoxies. Their claims of authority, their failure to conform to the majority's liberal consensus, and ultimately their threat to democracy. So just orthodox, an anxiety over orthodoxy. And I've seen that in people. Often it's anxiety, which is to say it's not really quite a clear and distinct fear over a specific object, but just kind of a broad concern that this is a threat. This church that has a hierarchy, a structure, it has a majesty, it has a tradition. Any kind of church, any organization that seems to possess some internal ideal coherence is worrisome.
Right. So one of my goals in the book was to understand the nature of prejudice in a democracy. We all think we understand prejudice. We can identify some clear examples. But prejudice isn't apt to prevail in a popular society, in popular politics, if it's portrayed simply as something negative. It appeals to people because they see it as something actually, on the contrary, quite idealistic and positive. It appeals to their sense of themselves. So in these circumstances, how should one understand prejudice? And I think at least in the examples I was looking at here, what one's looking at is a series of anxieties that are taken so far as to be not only slightly unreasonable, but to be prejudice. And I don't want to criticize all anxieties. One can be reasonably anxious about the authority of someone else's speech. For example, if I were to speak very harshly to you, you might reasonably be upset. But to generalize those anxieties to the point that you want to deprive organizations of their freedom of speech suggests that we're going beyond just ordinary fears.
It almost sounds as if that the liberal strain is uncomfortable with any form of ideal commitment once it attracts just some kind of critical mass.
Right. I'm not sure I want to go that far, at least about contemporary liberalism. Certainly, there have been wonderful examples of this in the past. So one notable late 19th century organization was the National Liberal League. And there's some very funny speeches by some of its leaders, including one rabbi, who urged his listeners to support the separation of church and state, but then said, oh, but of course, I don't want to be dogmatic about this. You shouldn't do it merely because I say so. And he's almost apologetic about it. I think many people in the groups that have inherited those traditions, some of the ethical cultural society speakers, sometimes echo that sense of hesitation about asserting oneself. It's very elegant. But the reality is that in politics and in much of our culture, it's very easy for everyone to get carried away with its own views and not worry so much as to whether or not one's being dogmatic. Mm-hmm. So, who knows? I remain agnostic on this.
The 501c3, it is so embedded in civic life now. All institutions, I mean, we're a 501c3, all, you know, the whole education system, the whole religion, vast portion of America is 501c3. Is anything going to change in the next 10 years? I mean, you hear threats about churches being, I mean, theorists, progressive legal minds will say, why should churches have some special dispensation here? What's so special about them? Let me put it this way. As our social and civic life gets more and more political and partisan, mm-hmm. will the 501c3 category begin to grow smaller?
I don't know whether that's very likely, but let me take another angle on this. Section 501c3 began to limit the speech of churches in 1934, and then even more emphatically 1954. And since then, the IRS has enforced its restrictions with growing threats. In fact, it's not going to pursue this to the point of litigation anymore now that it has Supreme Court precedent on its side, but it does try to make churches fear enforcement.
Well, who wants to fight the IRS?
I don't know. It'd be fun.
It's pretty
cool. As a former tax lawyer, I'm not adverse to that. But if one thinks about what happened to the social and political role of churches and where people find their voice, the reality is that after mid-century, many Americans no longer found an expression of their most idealistic and fervent feelings about politics in their institutions. And in the 1960s, they take those feelings out into the streets. Now, I don't want to blame 501c3 for that. I think that that's unprovable and is probably taking it too far. But I don't think these things are connected. We've essentially delegitimized our opportunities to pursue politics in our religious organizations. And as a result, the only place for pursuing such our stronger ideals is outside these institutions. And the result is that they often get expressed in less coherent and less measured ways. Mm-hmm. There probably was some advantage to pursuing one's fervent feelings through churches that results in a very different style of politics than has resulted in our separation of churches from the political sphere.
You know, I did a book on Atlanta. There was a big riot in Atlanta 100 years ago, and I sort of wrote a hour-by-hour account of it. But I spent a few years going through newspapers and city council documents, the minutes of the alderman board meetings and so on. And I was struck at how involved local ministers, black as well as white ministers, were in city politics. They would bring ministers in to address the city council on issues all the time. They would ask their opinion about what they'd ask them openly, where your parishioners stand on different things. What is the public sentiment? And so cultivating the input of religious leaders in the city, and this was unremarkable.
Right.
It was so normal to have it happen. The newspapers, you know, the main public forums for political discussion would reprint sermons that were issued that Sunday. The ministers would send the copy of their sermons to the newspapers to be published, and they were heavily political. And it was just, again, it was no one would ever think to find separation in church and state being crossed here or raising issues of, I mean, this was 1906, so before the income tax was out there. But it was so religion and politics were understood as a religious vision incorporates everything.
Right. And this was particularly true, of course, for the black churches. At one point, I read every publication of black Baptists in America up through the early 20th century. And it's quite remarkable how self-conscious black Baptist ministers were about this, as they often would explain. We've been deprived of our political leadership. We've been prevented from developing a secular political leadership. And so ministers have to play a role in defending the black community from the white majority. And this has continued to be true, even if not quite to the extent as in the past.
And did you find other cases where the white leadership would actually consult with the black religious leaders about community issues?
I know this obviously happens even now, but not quite as publicly.
Let's spend a few minutes on John Rawls,
the
towering figure of political liberalism.
Not by design, but it sort of inevitably, the book had to deal with John Rawls. And there's a chapter on political theory, because it turns out that there's a style of American political theory in the 20th century, what you might call liberal democratic theory, that arises out of this theologically liberal and nativist tradition. And it's not to say its exponents, and least of all, of course, John Rawls, were themselves nativist. And nor should we assume that their philosophy was self-consciously theological. But their background often was in theology, and theologically liberal concerns about the speech of ecclesiastical and other idealistic organizations was very much on their minds. And so in John Rawls's theory, we see really the most elegant account of this. He wants to exclude certain sorts of speech, if not legally, at least morally exclude certain sorts of speech, deprive of its legitimacy. And what is this speech to be excluded? Well, that which is not based on public reason, primarily. Public reason, of course, is that which is accessible to all, and that ends up producing, of course, a sort of oppressive consensus in which divergent perspectives really have no place at the table. And he, in fact, is quite explicit in lesser known portions of his book, Political Liberalism. He actually spells out that churches and professional organizations and universities are the sort of organizations whose speech generally is not public reason and therefore cannot be part of the political debate. So although he's not trying to defend 501c3 and its speech restrictions, he's writing in the same spirit. And the perspective we see there is remarkably aligned with the perspective that we see arising from people like Hiram Evans, which is not to associate the two, that's not the goal, but it is disturbing to see this theme, this perspective, this slant running all the way through some of the worst of American history and some of the best of its philosophy.
Would Rawls have been pleased to find political speech in the public square entirely drained of religious meaning? Religious beliefs? No,
of course not. In fact, the Klan, in a sense, is a religious organization, isn't it? There are even rituals for Klan church services and the like. But he would distinguish between the religious and the religious opinion and church opinion. In fact, he would suggest that religious opinion cannot be church opinion, and church opinion cannot be really religious. And this is a standard nativist trope. It's not just the Klan. From their perspective, the Catholic Church isn't really a church, of course, right? It's a political organization from their perspective.
You say here, it is disconcerting, even shocking, to think that there is a heritage of dark anxieties that runs through American liberalism, from early theological liberals to nativists, and ultimately to men as thoughtful as John Rawls. But this is the reality. Rawls's liberalism fits within the history of liberalism, including theological liberalism and nativism.
Yes, sadly it's true. And I guess I ought to emphasize, this is not a critique wholesale of liberalism. I and I suspect you were all liberal in some sense. We're intellectuals, we enjoy individual thought, we like to think for ourselves. But the idea that you can't think for yourself because you choose to be in a church which has a sense of ecclesiastical authority, it contradicts, you know, the entire history of Catholicism and indeed of all religious organizations. And the great danger, of course, it's not just religious. The danger is actually to the polity. We've actually stripped our society of the organizations that allow individuals successfully and effectively to pursue their ideas in public. And as Tocqueville warned, that could come with a very high cost. The book, in fact, ends on the danger of shallowness in politics. I don't want to blame 501c3 for all of our shallowness. Surely we can take some credit ourselves. But it has had some role in this, I fear.
Professor Hamburger, thank you very much.
Thank you. It's been a great pleasure. Thank you.